Good. Well, it's good to see everyone here today for the new seminar series for this term. And as you'll see, we've got, I think, a really good series of talks this term. Before I forget, let me mention the one that will be happening in 2 weeks' time when we've got Michael Hoskin here from this college who will be speaking to us about God and Newton. So we've got a couple of seminars on history and philosophy of science to get us launched, and then we go into other kinds of areas later on in the term. Just to remind folk, and I remind myself, just to switch off your mobile phone if you wouldn't mind, and if you wouldn't mind putting it right off, not on standby, otherwise the sound is picked up on this rather sensitive system we've got here, so that'd be very, very useful. Thank you. If you're new to this series and you would like to listen to some of the previous seminars we've had over the past few terms, then they're all up on our website. The web address is around the place somewhere. And do look us up. It's in the multimedia folder. And we've got both MP3 streams as well as the video streams for most of our talks up there. So do go and browse. There's quite a good repertoire there. Today we welcome John Van Wy, who's from the Centre for the Research in Arts and Social Sciences and Humanities here in Cambridge. Bit of a mouthful, otherwise known more locally as CRASH. Actually, I did a search. I was telling John over lunch, I did a search for John Van Wy versus CRASH in Google, you know, just to find a little biographical detail. And it sparked up, in fact, his name, but together with the other type of CRASH, because their website had crashed when they first put up his own project, which is the Online Darwin Project. And when it went live on the first day, there were how many million, John? There were many million.
5 million.
5 million hits on that site on the first day. And I think that did crash the server. So I think that gives you some indication of the huge interest that there still is worldwide in this whole Darwin industry, if you want to call it that. John did his PhD here in Cambridge. In fact, he's never really left Cambridge. He's did a PhD in 19th century phrenology, so if you need any help in that area afterwards, he can also help you on any bumps in your head. And he's carried on working at CRASH now for the past 2 years, and we're delighted that he's come to speak to us on Darwin's loss of faith. So, over to you, John.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for the invitation to speak on Darwin's religion. I should say, first of all, that I make no claim to being a particular expert on Darwin's religious views. Any work starting out on this field has to build on the earlier work of historians like James Moore, John Brooke, Randall Keynes, and others. So, Darwin's loss of faith. If Darwin were aware that we were here today discussing his religious views, he would cringe, because he often said that my religious views don't concern anyone else, and they shouldn't really be of interest to anyone else. And the fact that so long after his death we're still discussing his religious views would not have been entirely welcome. In fact, Darwin once wrote, "I have never systematically thought much on religion in relation to science, or on morals in relation to society, and without steadily keeping my mind on such subjects for a long period, I am really incapable of writing anything worth publishing." Well, so why should it matter to us today what Charles Darwin thought about religion? Well, despite being dead since 1882, Darwin is in a sense very much alive in the debates about creationism, science and evolution, and their relation to society today. And Darwin's image is an icon in these debates. He's torn this way and that. Darwin is either the saint, it's Pope Darwin. If you search for things like Darwin, saint and sinner on Google, you can find gems like this one. So, you know, he's represented as both a saint and a sinner. Here he is with his notorious sidekick, Alfred Russel Mussolini. I think some pranks have put these images together. But anyway, a more contemporary image, this is from 1904, represents Darwin as the referee in a boxing match between the great prize fight for championship of the world between G. Hover, the celestial crusher, and B. L. Zebub, the pet of pandemonium. And you can see that the referee, Mr. Darwin, here has the origin of species under his arm. the deciding document, as it were. Well, here's a more slightly more fair caricature of Darwin from Vanity Fair, showing Darwin with a characteristic grin and the typical way that he used to sit in a chair. Well, so Darwin's image is torn this way and that. Everyone wants to have Darwin on their side, or indeed to discredit Darwin in order to help their own side. But let's look at the real man and what he thought and wrote. If we just go through a brief summary of Darwin's life. Darwin was born in 1809 in Shrewsbury, was educated at the local public school before being sent to Edinburgh to study medicine for a couple of years, but he didn't much like that, and he particularly couldn't bear watching operations or witnessing pain and distress or the sight of blood, so it wasn't particularly good qualifications for becoming a physician. So his family decided that another respectable alternative profession for him would be the church. Darwin had some time to think about that, but he didn't object. Being a country parson would be actually quite a nice way to spend his time studying natural history as his interests in that area grew. So he then had to come up to Cambridge to take an English degree in order to proceed to the church, which never quite worked out. As we all know, Darwin, shortly after Cambridge, sailed on the HMS Beagle on his famous voyage around the world, discovering lots of new species and studying the geology and biogeography of the countries visited. He returns to England in 1836. He gets married and he begins a life of scientific toil, publishing books and writing lots and lots of letters, as the correspondence project still suffers from, I think. Thousands and thousands. He worked and worked, and of course his most famous book is On the Origin of Species. I'll talk more about the meaning of The Origin of Species later on, but I'll just briefly say now that it was, from the day it was published, considered by many to be an intervention in the debate about God's role in running the universe, in running nature. Many people thought that Darwin was trying to kick God right out of nature. Other people thought, oh great, Mr. Darwin has shown in an even nicer way how God actually runs things. So there was never agreement, even from the beginning, how one ought to accept Darwin's theory in a theological point of view. Darwin himself was quite happy to believe that natural laws were how the Creator ran the universe. Now, before we can talk about Darwin's loss of faith, we have to know what that faith was. What did he believe? What is the story of Darwin's Christianity? Well, it starts with his baptism in this church, St. Chad's in Shrewsbury, where he was baptized in November 1809. This is a Church of England, but his mother was a Unitarian, a Wedgwood Unitarian, and so Darwin was actually taken on Sundays to this church with his sisters. And after her death, his sisters carried on. So Darwin has two theological paternities, as it were. Now, interestingly, Darwin's father was a skeptic and was not a church-going man, but his wife and his children did. And Darwin himself did the same thing when he had his own family. He didn't go to church, but his wife and his children did. Now, we know from what Darwin recorded in his autobiography and other writings quite a lot about what he thought on many of these religious questions. He says of his former beliefs before he lost his faith, "Formerly, I was led by feelings of inward conviction in the existence of an intelligent God." And indeed, this was encouraged when at Cambridge he read the works of the famous natural theologian William Paley, especially his Evidences of Christianity, which Darwin thought was a very satisfying justification for Christian belief. So, in sum, Darwin, quote, said he had a firm conviction of the existence of God and the immortality of the soul, but I do not think that the religious sentiment was ever strongly developed in me. So, of course, you have to remember that his grandfather, his father, his brother, and many of his friends were unbelievers. So, Darwin did have a conventional religious upbringing, and he believed what he was taught. He had no particular reason to question it. He was quite happy to do so. But we shouldn't be surprised that coming from a background like this, that Darwin did eventually lose his faith. So, Darwin's loss of faith. And this whole story of Darwin losing his faith has been wrapped up in a celestial debate like this caricature from Punch. The first thing we know about Darwin and his loss of faith is his slight worry in his Cambridge days about swearing to the 39 Articles. Now, I don't think that it's generally accepted that this was evidence, the first evidence of Darwin's skepticism. I think that's true. He was probably, like any young man, not quite sure about all of the details, but he did in the end do so. But his daughter Elizabeth Darwin later recalled after Darwin's death, he says it was difficult enough for him even then to drill his reason into accepting the doctrines of the church, although he was at that time and for some time after quite orthodox. So perhaps there is something in that, those early observations. On board the Beagle voyage, Darwin often recalled that he was still quite an orthodox believer. It's often recorded that Darwin cited the Bible as an unanswerable authority and that the officers laughed at him. But Elizabeth, in her recollections of Darwin, actually gives quotes her father's words that correspond to this event. And she says, she's quoting her father, "Well, if the Bible is true, that is wrong, you know," which was received with roars of laughter, though the officers were religious men. So this little tidbit is something that we know of Darwin's religious belief while he's on board the Beagle. But I think during that time he is already, some things are starting to crumble. Most of what we know about Darwin's loss of faith is from the autobiography, although a substantial amount is from his letters and from other recollections of friends and family after his death. So Darwin wrote a very detailed description in his autobiography called, the section is called Religious Belief. And he recalls, "Before I was engaged to be married," that's in 1839, after coming home from the Beagle voyage, "my father advised me to conceal carefully my doubts." Aha, well there they are, doubts. They're there at this date, and his father knew about them, and they had a chat about it. His father advised him not to tell any prospective wife about his religious doubts, because this would cause her unnecessary pain or suffering. Well, he didn't follow the advice. He did tell his young future wife, Emma Wedgwood. And we know something of their conversation because of the letters she wrote to Darwin on the subject. And we don't know what Darwin told her, but it is possible to make out something of what he said from the content of her letters. And she wrote, "While you are acting conscientiously and sincerely wishing and trying to learn the truth, may not the habit in scientific pursuits of believing nothing till it is proved influence your mind too much in other things which cannot be proved in the same way?" And she went on to apologize for bothering Darwin, saying, "Don't think that it is not my affair and that it does not much signify to me. I'm rather afraid my own dear will think I have forgotten my promise not to bother him." Aha. So they've been having conversations about this, and for one reason or another, Emma has promised not to bother Darwin on the subject of religion. And I think she generally followed that for the rest of their life. I think they didn't talk too much about it. She knew what he thought, and he knew what she thought. And they both respected one another deeply. So I think to avoid too much unnecessary turbulence, they steered clear while they were playing backgammon. So Darwin was reluctant, as he tells us in the autobiography, to give up his belief. He didn't set out to attack or to lose his Christianity. And while his doubt began to grow, he remembers imagining evidence being found that might actually prove Christianity to be true. He imagined, well, what if some letters were found in Pompeii, in the ruins between Roman senators or something, that might actually prove in the finest detail that the Gospels were true. And he found that even with free range given to his imagination over time, he just couldn't imagine the evidence that would be sufficient to convince him of the particular stories in the New Testament. Now, I'll move on now to Darwin's description of the kinds of evidence, the reasons why he lost his faith. And my point today is that most of those reasons, the kinds of evidence that Darwin found persuasive, are what we might call comparative anthropology. They stem from Darwin's awareness of the kinds of beliefs that exist across the globe amongst different populations and different tribes. Darwin is so keenly aware of the big picture that he then tries to put his own culture into that puzzle, rather than seeing that as the only way of thinking. So Darwin, who is now by this time a great geologist and a respected member of the scientific community, writes, this is his recollection, "But I had gradually come by this time," this is after the Beagle Voyage, "to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world with the Tower of Babel, the rainbow as a sign, etc., etc., and from its attributing to God the feelings of a revengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian." Those are harsh words for mild-mannered Mr. Darwin. And then he mentions another point, which has similar effect on him. "The fact that many false religions have spread over large portions of the earth like wildfire had some weight with me." Now, this is similar to a remark Darwin makes elsewhere about an incorrect scientific view, which he realizes someone had got something wrong and had been telling the story. And he writes in one of his letters that here a false view had spread over a large part of the country without any evidence for it being true. Now, he doesn't connect this to his ideas about religion whatsoever, but it is a similar type of observation about Darwin thinking about the spread of ideas. He goes on to say, this is another one of these anthropological points for doubt in the autobiography, "Is it credible that if God were now to make a revelation to the Hindus, would he permit it to be connected with the belief in Vishnu, Shiva, etc., as Christianity is connected with the Old Testament? This appeared to me utterly incredible." So this is yet another one of these anthropological points that Darwin's put together. He goes on to say, "By further reflecting that the clearest evidence would be requisite to make any sane man believe in the miracles by which Christianity is supported," and then he goes on to give a long list of the kinds of problems he's found in his own thinking, "that the more we know of the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible do miracles become. That the men at that time," i.e. the gospel writers, "were ignorant and credulous to a degree almost incomprehensible by us. And that the gospels cannot be proved to have been written simultaneously with the events." Now that is an appeal to German biblical criticism and his awareness of it. And his next point, "that the Gospels differ in many important details, far too important, as it seemed to me, to be admitted as the usual inaccuracies of eyewitnesses." So by that point in the autobiography, Darwin has basically, as far as he's concerned, his belief in Christianity has been killed off because of these kinds of reasons and that kind of thinking. And he goes on to say, "I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true, for if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that men who do not believe, and this would include my father, brother, and almost all of my best friends, will be everlastingly punished, and this is a damnable doctrine." Now, this is one of the harshest sentences I've ever seen written by Charles Darwin. It's almost uncharacteristic of him to be so negative and so damning. Now that's Darwin's loss of his faith in Christianity. But we can treat separately Darwin's belief in the existence of a personal God. And this is something he gives a lot of treatment to. Here's a longish quote from Darwin. "At the present day, the most usual argument for the existence of an intelligent God is drawn from the deep inward conviction and feelings which are experienced by most persons. But it cannot be doubted that Hindus, Mohammedans, and others might argue in the same manner and with equal force of the existence of one God, or of many gods, or, as with the Buddhists, of no God. There are also many barbarian tribes who cannot be said with any truth to believe in what we call God. They believe indeed in spirits or ghosts, and it can be explained how such a belief would be likely to arise. So here yet again is the anthropological awareness coming in. Now Darwin's 1871 book, The Descent of Man, he makes a similar reference to the pervasiveness of the belief in one God as an argument for the existence. And this is what he writes in The Descent of Man. A belief in all-pervading spiritual agencies seems to be universal and apparently follows from a considerable advance in man's reason and from a still greater advance in his faculties of imagination, curiosity, and wonder. And as a footnote to that, I would note that those sound a bit like phrenological faculties, but that's probably a coincidence. I am aware that the assumed instinctive belief in God has been used by many persons as an argument for his existence. But this is a rash argument, as we should thus be compelled to believe in the existence of many cruel and malignant spirits, only a little more powerful than man. For the belief in them is far more general than a beneficent deity. So here, in one of his few published statements on this theme, he is again using his knowledge of comparative anthropology as evidence. He goes on to discuss this in his autobiography in a similar vein about the existence of God because of what most people believe. This argument would be a valid one if all men of all races had the same inward conviction of the existence of one God. But we know that this is very far from being the case. Therefore, I cannot see that such inward convictions and feelings are of any weight as evidence of what really exists. He then goes on, and I'm cutting and pasting quite liberally just to get his comments thematically grouped together. But he goes on to say, nor must we overlook the probability of the constant inculcation in a belief in God on the minds of children producing so strong and perhaps an inherited effect on their brains not yet fully developed, and that it would be as difficult for them to throw off their belief in God as for a monkey to throw off its instinctive fear and hatred of a snake. Now, Emma Darwin found this idea offensive. And when Darwin died, the family had a bit of a quarrel about publishing the autobiography. She thought some of these statements were a bit raw. So this particular one was not included because Emma thought, she said, it was painful to me, your father's view, that something like an inert belief in God is comparable to a monkey's instinct. Now she didn't like that at all. That was demeaning for her. But Darwin several times does compare such views with inherited instinct, because Darwin, of course, wanted to trace the origins of various kinds of thinking to inherited instincts from earlier species, our ancestral species. Now, I suppose the next point that Darwin discusses in his loss of faith discussion with himself is the question of pain and evil in the world. And this is a classic point, you know, the existence of suffering. It's a problem. How can it be explained? Well, this was Darwin's take on it in the autobiography. A being so powerful and so full of knowledge as a God who could create the universe is to our finite minds omnipotent and omniscient, and it revolts our understanding to suppose that his benevolence is not unbounded. For what advantage can there be in the sufferings of millions of the lower animals throughout almost endless time? Now here Darwin is of course thinking of his deep knowledge of the geological record, of his understanding of countless thousands of what he called vile molluscous creatures in the geological record, which had been apparently created and gone extinct on and on through the eons, with no human beings on the earth yet to appreciate them. So Darwin is bringing in his geological knowledge here. He goes on to say, this very old argument for the existence of suffering against the existence of an intelligent first cause seems to me a strong one. Whereas the presence of much suffering agrees well with the view that all organic beings have been developed through variation and natural selection. Now, after The Origin of Species and The Descent of Man, Darwin was already such a a famous figure that he gets lots of mail from people asking him all sorts of silly things, including, oh, come on, tell me what your religious beliefs are. And Darwin does often respond to these, although he doesn't have a lot of time, as say he would if someone asked him a point about a scientific question. Now, a Dutch student wrote to Darwin in 1873 asking him a question like this. And Darwin responded, "I may say that the impossibility of conceiving that this grand and wondrous universe with our conscious selves arose through chance. It seems to me that this is the chief argument for the existence of God. But whether this is an argument of real value, I have never been able to decide. I am aware that if we admit a first cause, the mind still craves to know whence it came and how it arose. Nor can I overlook the difficulty from the immense amount of suffering through the world. I am also induced to defer to a certain extent the judgment of many of the able men who have fully believed in God. But here again, I see how poor an argument this is. The safest conclusion seems to me that the whole subject is beyond the scope of man's intellect." And so that was Darwin's sort of cut-off point. I don't really know what is at the origin of all things, but he does not give up a belief in a creator. Now, he discussed the convincing nature of this argument elsewhere. He says, "Another source of conviction in the existence of God impresses me as having much more weight. This follows from the extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving this immense and wonderful universe, including man, as a result of blind chance or necessity. When thus reflecting, I feel compelled to look to a first cause, having an intelligent mind in some degree analogous to that of man, and I deserve to be called a theist. This conclusion was strong in my mind about the time, as far as I can remember, when I wrote The Origin of Species, which was 1859. And it is since that time that it has very gradually, and with many fluctuations, become weaker." Now, Darwin wrote his autobiography in 1876, so he's looking back on 1859. So, to summarize, Darwin describes his loss of faith in Christianity and a personal God as a gradual process. He says many times that it was a long, slow, gradual process, which he experienced without any distress, because it was so slow and gradual. So Darwin himself concludes exactly like this. "But by such reflections as these, as I have outlined, I gradually came to disbelieve in Christianity as a divine revelation." And in a similar statement, "Disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress, and have never since doubted, even for a single second, that my conclusion was correct." Okay, what conclusion? What does he mean? What's he talking about? Well, Darwin is referring to Christianity as a human-created belief system. This is what he's concluded, that as a human-generated belief system, like all the others in the world, as he's seen from his viewpoint of comparative anthropology. And therefore, he rejects final judgment or redemption and the existence of an eternal soul. And definitely no, he does not believe in a personal God to whom one could pray. He wrote in a letter to yet another correspondent, I cannot pretend to throw the least light on such abstruse problems. The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us, and I, for one, must be content to remain an agnostic. I'll just read you one more. No. Well, he's just called himself an agnostic, but in a few quotes before, he called himself a theist. So Darwin is not entirely consistent in the language he uses to describe his own views. And this is probably because his views weren't entirely consistent. He says himself they changed over time, there were fluctuations, they went up and down. So he does indeed use the word theist, but also uses the word agnostic. And actually, that doesn't seem entirely consistent, because he is an agnostic who, as he says, never gives up belief in the existence of a creator. Well, he actually believes this. He believes there is one. So how can he be an agnostic? I think he likes that word far better than atheist, but we'll get to that later on. Another correspondent writes to him asking to know about his religious views and what is the relationship between your theory and Christ. And Darwin writes back, "Science has nothing to do with Christ, except insofar as the habit of scientific research makes a man cautious in admitting evidence. I do not believe that there has ever been any revelation. As for a future life, every man must judge for himself between conflicting, vague probabilities." So we have so many different sources saying pretty similar things by Darwin about his loss of faith and indeed his post-faith views on the score of Christianity, personal God, eternal life, and the creation of the universe. He says in another letter, "I may state that my judgment often fluctuates. In my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of a God. I think that generally, and more as I grow older, but not always, that an agnostic would be the more correct description of my state of mind." So if you were asked to write a biographical encyclopedia entry on Darwin and you had two sentences to describe his religious belief, would you say he was a theist or an agnostic? Well, it'd be very difficult to say because he seems to claim that he's both. He does claim that he's both. But one important thing to remember about Darwin and his religious views is that he was never dogmatic. He took no steps to make others think as he did. He didn't publish on the subject of religion. And indeed, in an 1880 letter to the atheist campaigner Edward Averling, Darwin wrote, "I am a strong advocate for free thought on all subjects. Yet it appears to me that direct arguments against Christianity and theism produce hardly any effect on the public, and freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds which follows from the advance of science." So, of course, Darwin practiced what he preached. He didn't try to inculcate his children with a similar skepticism. Emma Darwin took them to church every Sunday. And Darwin did nothing to hinder this. But indeed, that's similar to what his own father had done. His own father had been a skeptic, and Darwin was taken to church by his mother and sisters and taught to be a good Christian. So it seems to have been a matter, not just for Darwin himself, but for his family background, to be a matter of personal conscience. So what practical effects did this loss of faith actually have for Darwin? Well, we have an interesting recollection from Francis Darwin, who was born in 1848. He recalls after his father's death what his father used to. He says, Darwin had rather a prejudice against young curates and bishops and enjoyed the proverb, "A bench of bishops is the devil's flower garden." Now, there's lots of little sayings like this where you can see that Darwin liked to poke fun at religion, but that's, of course, in the private sphere of his own family and their private conversation. Francis Darwin goes on to record that his father worked on Sundays exactly the same hours as on other days. The only occasion which I can remember his being at church were the christening in 1856 of the baby Charles who died and the funeral of Uncle Erasmus. The first occasion, the christening, I only remember because my father was there, which to us children was an extraordinary and abnormal occurrence. And of course that's this church in the village of Down, Kent. Now a slightly different recollection is from Darwin's niece, Julia Wedgwood. This is also written after Darwin's death. "Everyone, I suppose, who feels religion infinitely the most important subject of human attention would be aware of a certain hostility towards it in his attitude, so far as it was revealed in private life. He had no hostility towards religion as a view of the ultimate origin of things. Yet when religion appeared as concerning itself with forces now at work in the world, then I think it always seemed to him a belief that brought disorder and was hostile to all true science," spelled with a capital S. "And so, of course, he was hostile to it." Now, this is the not altogether sympathetic recollections of Darwin's niece. Now, in 1881, Darwin had a visitor, Edward Averling again, had some visitors to come to lunch, and they wanted to talk to Darwin about atheism. And they wanted Darwin to approve. Well, I think in order to make Emma feel a bit better, they invited their old vicar along to sit at the table with them, which I think was quite good fun. And they all sat together, had a very nice lunch, and then afterwards the men retired to the smoking room. And Darwin cut into them straight away. Not exactly characteristic for Darwin. He wasn't dodging the questions. No, he said straight away, "So, why do you call yourselves atheists?" And we know about this because Aveling later published a pamphlet after Darwin's death called The Religious Views of Charles Darwin. Darwin's son Francis mentions this in a footnote in Life and Letters, and he says that although he doesn't exactly agree with what Aveling is trying to do in publishing this pamphlet, he does say that he has given a fair view. Francis was in the room, I should say. So he gives a fair view of my father's views. So then Aveling goes on to answer Darwin's question, "Why do you call yourselves atheists?" "The explanation was given that we were atheists because there was no evidence of deity, because the invention of a name was not an explanation of phenomena, because the whole of man's knowledge was of a natural order, and only when ignorance closed in on his onward path was the supernatural invoked. It was pointed out that whilst we did not commit the folly of God denial, we avoided with equal care the folly of God assertion." So Darwin listened to all of this with patience, and according to Aveling, he agreed with point after point of our argument, saying at last, "I am with you in thought, but I should prefer the word agnostic to the word atheist." Now, the atheists weren't satisfied with this. They really wanted to get Darwin on their side, so they could wave the banner of "Mr. Darwin approves of atheism." And so they tried and tried to get him to agree. And so they said, "Well, surely, Mr. Darwin, agnostic is but an atheist writ respectable. An atheist is only agnostic writ aggressive." But Darwin wasn't put off by this. He replies, "But why should you be so aggressive? Is anything to be gained by trying to force these new ideas upon the mass of mankind? It is all very well for the educated, cultured, thoughtful people, but are the masses yet ripe for it?" Well, they tussled back and forth, and they couldn't come to any more agreement about the word atheism, or indeed how to promote skepticism. But Darwin did mention to them that he himself had not been like them, that he was not a dogmatic, anti-religious person, and that indeed in his own case, it had been a very slow, gradual case of assessing the evidence and changing his mind. And to demonstrate this, he mentions to them, "I never gave up Christianity until I was 40 years of age." Well, that would be February 1849, but of course he doesn't literally mean on that day or anything like that. I'm sure we can take that as a round number. The pamphlet goes on, "As to why he abandoned it, the reply, simple and all-sufficient, was, it is not supported by the evidence." Now, that's a pretty good summary of the discussion he had already written in his autobiography. And of course, it was not yet published while Darwin was still alive, but it is a consistent summary of Darwin's more complex description of his loss of faith. Now, many people have no doubt heard of the deathbed conversion story. Charles Darwin, on his deathbed, converted to Christianity, and in some versions of the story, said, "I take back all that I said about evolution. It's all wrong." To some, this is a very comforting story. Others might say, "Well, you know, does it really matter what Darwin said? If an old and delirious man lay dying, are you really going to change your view of the world because of his final utterances?" But James Moore has very carefully investigated this story in a book called The Darwin Legend, and he shows, I think, absolutely conclusively where the story came from, how it changed once it had entered the public sphere and became repeated and modified down the years. There is some possibility that the first person to promulgate the story may have actually met Darwin, or we're not sure, but it's quite plausible. She was in the area. But the words she attributes to Darwin, and for example her coming in and seeing Darwin sitting there reading the Bible and he quotes out various passages, so that's not Darwin. And to anyone who knows Darwin, it's not believable. And his family, once they heard about these stories, they wrote very vigorously lots of letters to the editor and that sort of thing, denying the truth of these stories. Well, I mean, here he is, the old bearded man that we're all so familiar with. To conclude, Darwin saw his own loss of faith as part of a social context in which, as he wrote in his autobiography, "nothing is more remarkable than the spread of skepticism or rationalism during the latter half of my life. So you see, Darwin sees this not only as an individual phenomenon that has happened to himself, but he sees it as something happening in the community of which he is a part. His loss of faith was similar to many of his friends and family. His son, you know, Darwin said earlier, I said earlier in Darwin's autobiography, he says, I don't think the religious sentiment was ever particularly strong with me. And almost the same words are echoed in a recollection by his son William after Darwin's death. He said exactly the same. He said, my father had no religious sentiment. He didn't seem like a religious man. Well, we can see from Darwin's recollections and from the letters and recollections of other people that his faith gradually receded as his skeptical rationalism and requirement for evidence increased. And this happened precisely at the time when Darwin was at his most busiest, when he was writing many of the books as a result of the Beagle Voyage. He was writing in his private notebooks about his new theory of evolution. He's thinking about the origins of man, about the relationship between man's mind and that of lower animals. And so some of the most dramatic scientific thoughts happen in conjunction with Darwin's loss of faith. They happen in the same years. But it seems to be the years in which, as you can see from his comments on materialism, his comments on the origin of man, many of which he doesn't publish for very many years, these are the recorded thoughts of a young man trying to figure things out, trying to figure out how does the universe work, how does it all work, what do I think, what are my views, and he works them all out in these notebooks. And so in the autobiography, when Darwin's looking back and describing his loss of faith, it is to this period in his life that he's referring. Now, as was typical of Darwin, he took both a very very minute, detailed view of religion and also a very wide sort of world-scale view. And this is similar to his work on the species question. He considered a very broad range of evidence, and he compared Christianity with what was known about the distribution of beliefs across the world, both now and in the past. So, according to Darwin himself, it was his gradual appreciation that his former beliefs in Christianity and a personal God were not supported by sufficient evidence, and indeed that the available evidence of many kinds allowed for the continuation of his belief in a creator who started the universe off, but as far as could be demonstrated, as Darwin wrote, and this is my final quote, everything in nature is the result of natural law. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John, for that wonderful overview. And maybe I could just pick the questions up, actually, with often in these accounts, one hears a lot about his daughter Annie, I think it was, and how she died sadly at the age of 12, and how that played a major role in Darwin's loss of faith and so forth. And that certainly hasn't been part of your narrative today. Do you want to just comment on that type of personal loss and whether that played any role at all?
Well, I should say, first of all, that some historians who have spent a lot more time than I have working on this question are believe that that is the case. And indeed, Annie's death does fall about the right time in his life. I mean, if Darwin estimates February 1849 and Annie dies in 1851, it's about the right time. But it doesn't form part of any of Darwin's recollections. And so what I've done today is both to stick to Darwin's recollections and the recollections of people who knew him and his correspondence from the time. And Annie doesn't form part of that story.
My question is really on the same line. You obviously have an unusually, if not uniquely detailed knowledge of his life. And is there anything which comes to your notice what one calls a personal experience of Jesus Christ?
Yes, well, the short answer is no. there are no such recordings because I think the reason for that is, as Darwin said, the religious sentiment was never strongly developed with me. And that means that when he's thinking back to his childhood, when he was religious, and writing this autobiography about how he lost his faith, he tries to remember examples of his religiousness. And the only thing he could remember was that as a schoolboy, when he was running back and he had to be back in time, he would pray to God, please God, let me get back in time. And when he would make it, he would think, wow, great, wow, God did it. So he attributed his success to the prayer being successful rather than his speed in running. And this is something, of course, is just a little tidbit that he happened to remember many, many years later. So I find it interesting that really such a trivial example of religiosity is what he remembers as an example of his faith as a younger man. Had there been, you know, some more profound recollection that he could have inserted, I think he probably would have put it in.
He's been on the beagle for a few years and ran the horn, hasn't he?
Yes, indeed. He had indeed. Well, there is one moment recorded in his diary of Voyage of the Beagle, where he is so emotionally overcome with the view before him that he writes, surely no man could see this and believe that there is nothing in him but the breath in his body. Now that is probably the recollection you're looking for. Darwin actually writes about that recollection many years later. He doesn't actually refer to it explicitly, but he says, oh, long ago I said something like this, but today that would no longer happen to me because I feel that my moral sentence, my power to appreciate beauty has dwindled in my later years.
Yes. Do you think Darwin resisted the label of atheist because he didn't want to paint his work with a sort of advocacy that was related to the atheist at the time? Do you think that he would consider himself an atheist today?
No. No, he wouldn't. Darwin says pretty clearly that he never, ever questioned the bare existence of a creator. This is something that never dwindles from his belief, as far as we know, although of course there are these fluctuations, whatever those might be. But no, he never accepts. It's not just that he doesn't want the word, and of course, no, he doesn't want to be tainted by the word because in his social context, it is aggressive and it stands for a community he doesn't really want to be connected with. He does want to be distinguished from them. And his legacy is protected in that way. But even without that, he wouldn't have accepted being called an atheist because he didn't believe that there was no creator of the universe, with a small c, lowercase c.
Yes.
Yeah. I think what Darwin was trying to say with that remark, and which was echoed by his son after his death, was that although he was a conventional believer in Christianity, he went to church on Sunday, he attended chapel at Christ's every day, he read his Bible, he believed in God, he prayed to God, he believed that in an eternal soul, he believed in an afterlife, he believed the major tenets that he had been taught, like everyone around him. The point he was trying to make, I think, was that he wasn't a particularly keen Christian. You know, that he didn't have major emotional moments in a relationship to Christ or anything like that. He seems to have been somebody who went with the flow, as it were. And, well, whether or not his loss of faith was inevitable, I mean, that's an impossible question to answer. But it did happen. And it does seem to have something to do with his mental training as a young man of science. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that his science killed off his religion, because that That's a very different question.
Yes.
I was interested in the metaphor of the monkey and the snake, especially given that in the last few years, some evolutionary psychologists have suggested exactly the same thing, that belief in a supreme being may be a result of some genetic component in our nature.
Yeah.
Do you pursue that idea that perhaps religion was the outcome of some aspect of natural selection?
That's exactly Darwin. Darwin did believe that. I mean, he didn't obviously didn't know anything about genetics, but as you saw in one of these quotes, Darwin suspected it as likely or plausible that the constant inculcation of a belief in God in young children might, over a long enough period of time, because of course, you know, Darwin, we have to remember that there wasn't in Darwin's day a Lamarckism or Darwinism, because Darwin had always believed in the inheritance of acquired characteristics. I mean, this is just not something specific to Lamarck. Many, many people in the 19th century believed something like that. So Darwin believed this is one of the ways that characteristics get into, as we would say, into the gene pool, get into organisms, that they adopt new characteristics that would then be passed on to the offspring. So Darwin thought it was quite plausible that a belief in God, in a general sense, I mean, he obviously doesn't think that you're going to, you know, in the cradle, be able to turn to page, you know, such and such in the Bible, no. But he does mean that a general belief, a readiness to believe in God, could be made innate. What does that mean?
Let's come back to another question just on the history of it. So in his time in Edinburgh, I mean, Edinburgh was much more of a free-thinking atmosphere, I think, than the kind of respectable Anglicanism of Cambridge at the time, if I remember rightly. So is there any evidence that he sort of picked up this more free-thinking way of doing things, even during his brief time in Edinburgh? Is there just no real evidence?
Yeah, I'm afraid, I'm afraid the evidence just isn't very good as regards that during his time in Edinburgh. I mean, earlier authors who have tried to find, you know, the earliest origins of Darwin's skepticism or his loss of faith and whatever you want to call these sorts of things, as far back as we're able to go, according to the record, is Darwin's tentative worries about the swearing to the 39 articles, and that's at Cambridge. What his thoughts were before that, we just don't know.
Yes.
I think that the way you're looking at, and I can't remember, and if I could, with this Bygarden, it seems to be more along the lines of the kind of painful aspects of evolution, and instead of the kind of reason for God, it means that it's a painful, bloody mechanism for creating his world. And I just wondered about, do you know what I'm referring to? And
yes, Darwin says, makes several statements of that kind. He thinks that natural selection is demonstrates that you know, God is not benevolently zapping species into existence, zap, 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 new species. If that were the case, as some people have believed before then, Darwin said, no. You know, the facts just don't allow that to work. If we have to believe that, then we are forced to believe in a really nasty creator rather than a really nice one. And Darwin said, no, instead, imagine a creator who's so wise that he's simply able to say, right, these are the rules by which nature will function, set it in motion, and the after effects are more or less foreseeable, i.e. that he would have the creation of higher life forms. That was as much inevitability as he was prepared to accept. But yes, it's one of the major parts of Darwin's story, that he believed that through famine and death, through, I forget, it's in the final page of The Origin of Species, through the ruthless war of nature, that through suffering, death, disease, and destruction, that beautiful things are created by this terrible process. Well, it's a reflection of Darwin saying that he cannot, because of his understanding of nature, believe in the Christian benevolent deity. That is what he's saying. And instead, nature is cruel and ruthless. Yeah.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I came a bit later. I don't know, you were speaking about this very beginning, but I mean, to what extent was his encounter with Sigfrid, the work of the Beagle, important to understand me correctly, Lucy was really trying to kind of bring all evidence possible to find out that David was correct and so on. So I mean, being confronted with someone who really tries to practically subordinate the evidence for confirmation of his belief would have caused almost like a kind of counter-reaction.
Yes, well, many of the stories told about Darwin and Fitzroy and the Beagle Voyage don't fit the original evidence. During the Beagle Voyage, for example, there was a recent documentary in 2001 which represents, the very first scene is Darwin and Fitzroy coming up a hill in South America and they find this enormous fossil skull. And Darwin says, I wonder why they weren't extinct. And Fitzroy says, maybe they didn't fit through the door of the Ark. And Darwin goes, that is a totally wrong picture. Totally wrong. During the Beagle Voyage, as Darwin himself recalls, he says, I was totally orthodox. And Fitzroy, far from being a biblical literalist, a biblical fundamentalist, was in fact during the Beagle Voyage much more open to a scientific appreciation of the history of the world. There's a famous quote where Fitzroy is surveying this amazing geological landscape. And he says to a friend, obviously Darwin, this could never have been created in 7 days. And that's Fitzroy on the Beagle Launch. So actually they are not thinking unlike one another in those early days as very young men on this ship, on this amazing adventure. In fact, it's Captain Fitzroy who gives Darwin the first volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology. So Fitzroy was the one who wanted to have a naturalist taken along on the next voyage, because lots of important scientific discoveries could be made about the mineralogy, the plants and important minerals and things that might be found by someone who knew what they were doing and all these places they were going. It's a valuable opportunity, and he wanted to have a man of science along. I mean, sometimes you hear that, well, Darwin was just Fitzroy's companion. And well, he was his companion too, but he was first and foremost a naturalist. Fitzroy, when he's preparing for the second voyage, why does he write to the Admiralty to help him get a naturalist? If he wants a companion, well, he can find his own. But instead, a letter is sent up here to Cambridge. Can somebody find a naturalist to go on a voyage? And you don't need to send a letter to Cambridge to people you don't know to find a companion. So, of course, he had to be a companion too. He had to be a gentleman. And he was. So a gentleman naturalist was found in Cambridge. Someone who's just been a student at Christ College. He's a good general knowledge of science. And he's chosen once Fitzroy meets him and decides, yeah.
How did
these
letters arise?
Well, I think it arises because in later years, Fitzroy does become a fundamentalist. And this was not the Fitzroy of the early days, you see. So it's
projected the late stages of both Fitzroy and Darwin.
Back into their earlier life. So, for example, in the 1860 meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, where this famous event happens where Huxley says, Bishop Wilberforce says, are you descended from an ape, etc. You know the story. Well, Fitzroy's there, in the room. And in the hubbub afterwards, the people are moving around chatting. Fitzroy holds up the Bible and cries out, the book, the book. Now that's Fitzroy, the fundamentalist. But he's not the man who was on the Beagle Voyage. And then tragically, sometime later, he committed suicide. That's not a very nice note to end on, is it?
got 1 minute. I just wanted to ask you a more sort of general question. I mean, it seems to me a huge amount of number of legends have grown up around sort of the Darwin life and so forth. And do you think this is, why is that? Is it simply because people are trying to use him ideologically for all kinds of different justifications and so forth? And do you see hope that these mythologies are gradually being...
No. But if they were, historians would be out of a job. For example, take the legend of Darwin's finches. Mm-hmm. Over 20 years ago, Frank Selloway showed that it didn't happen. Darwin didn't have a eureka moment on the Galapagos. Now, all historians of science know this. But if you go out on the internet and hunt around on Google, that legend is alive and well to this day.
Well, that's a good note on the legends of Darwin. So thank you, John, very much indeed for a great talk.
Thank you.